Okay.
All right. So let's then really start our deliberations. And first, we're going to hear from Andrew what IFREC heard in its outreach.
Thank you, Hansen. Good morning, everybody. So I think my task is just to set up the discussion by giving an overview of what we have been hearing in our outreach over the past few months. So we have a short slide deck. If we can direct your attention to slide number 3. This is a very important project for Europe and therefore for EFRAG, and in the past decade and longer, EFRAG's been very engaged in the ongoing debate, including publishing two of our own discussion papers. So publication of the ISB's discussion paper is something of a landmark moment, and we've been doing a commensurate amount of work to ensure we can provide a constructive, legitimate and representative European view on the proposals. So in addition to our normal process of publishing a draft comment letter, we have been undertaking an extensive outreach programme and various other activities. Our draft comment letter was published in late August, so about 2 months into the ISB's comment period, and the draft comment letter is itself a public consultation document. Our comment period closed at the beginning of this week, but we'll in practice keep it open a little bit longer, so the opportunity is still there to comment on EFRAG's draft comments. If I just move on to some of our other activities and move on to slide 4, we've conducted 6, I'd say, fully fledged outreach events, which are all in partnership with other organisations, including European standard setters, and all in cooperation with the ISB, so we greatly appreciate that cooperation. But in total, we've had about 20 stakeholder engagement discussions, a number of which have been focused particularly on users, some have been more of a general audience, and we will summarise all of that feedback and bring that into our deliberations in finalising our comment letter on the discussion paper. And move on to slide 5. We're also piloting an initiative we're calling an early stage impact assessment. You might be aware that in EFRAG's role as the advisor to the European Commission on the endorsement of final ISB standards, we give a view on whether new standards will be conducive to the European public good, in addition to our view on the technical merits of the new standards. And the public good assessment is underpinned by a comprehensive impact assessment, which tries to explore the costs and benefits of the new standard, as well as the risk of any negative unintended consequences, broadly speaking. Our vision, though, is to, as far as possible, be able to front-load that analysis into the development stage of new standards so that the risk of unwelcome surprises emerging at the endorsement advice stage is reduced. It can't be eliminated altogether. So we are using this discussion paper to really try and build our capacity and learn something about what's feasibly achievable in the consultation phase. And one of the main sources of input for this are some surveys. We've opened a survey for preparers and another one aimed more at users. Those actually closed for comment at the end of November, so last Friday. We've had around 50 validated responses from preparers and around 35 from investors, which, based on, I guess, normal EFRAG response rates, is pretty good. So I think it indicates a high level of interest, a high level of commitment in the project. We have not yet, we're early stages of summarising all of that feedback, so the comments on what we're hearing so far is based on what we're hearing at the outreach events, not on the surveys, but we'll bring all of that into the mix. So moving on to slide 6, we've also done some work just to try and raise awareness both of the discussion paper and of EFRAG's draft comment letter, including a couple of stakeholder bulletins that aim to, they have a similar objective to the ISB snapshot document, trying to provide a more concise overview of the main points for those stakeholders that don't have the time or appetite to study a 150-page discussion paper. We've a webinar, and we've actually also launched a video featuring yours truly. So if you go on to YouTube and key Andrew Watchman Feiss, not Andrew Watchman Vice, because that would yield no results, but Andrew Watchman Vice, you could be the 283rd viewer.
That's 200 more than we get.
So okay. That's good. That's pretty good then. Yeah. I mean, I won't tell you how many of those are myself.
Okay.
So moving on to what we've been hearing, and I like the discussion paper, I'll try and structure this in terms of the classification proposals, the presentation proposals, and the disclosure proposals in the discussion paper. So moving on to slide 7 on the classification, and the speech bubbles, by the way, are clearly not comprehensive. They're intended to be a kind of balanced sample of the comments we've been hearing. On the classification, EFRAG's draft comment letter describes what we see as a balance. We certainly think there are potential advantages in having a clearer articulation of the concepts that underpin IAS 32. A clearer articulation could provide a better basis to develop more detailed application guidance and a better basis to determine the classification of the new types of instruments that will inevitably emerge as innovation continues in this space. So that's on the positive side, but on perhaps the less positive side, we see a risk of new confusion, new interpretive issues, and entities having to reassess their existing classifications, which could involve a lot of work for some entities, based on the intentions of the discussion paper, not to actually result in widespread classification changes. It could be a lot of work for not much change at the outcome of that exercise. So I have to say, sorry to say this, that overall I think the feedback we're hearing in the outreach is weighing more towards the negative side, more towards the risk of new confusion, or a sort of, is it already worth it? To the extent that the discussion paper does actually address known classification issues, where perhaps issues that have gone to the Interpretations Committee and the Interpretations Committee couldn't really resolve within the confines of IAS 32, we're hearing that that clarification comes more from the more detailed application guidance that's proposed in the discussion paper on things like foreign currency features, on anti-dilution provisions, and not so much from the timing and amount features themselves. I think the terminology, the labels, timing and amount feature, are perhaps not really adding to the clarity, if you will. Some aspects, particularly of the amount feature, and it's linked to recognised and unrecognised economic resources, are not intuitively obvious, if I can put it that way, to stakeholders. So that's broadly, I think, what we're hearing on the classification. That said, there is some acknowledgement that I would say with IAS 32 that there is room for improvement. And overall, it's not regarded as fundamentally broken, but some of the shortcomings, including the lack of guidance in some of the areas I've mentioned, I think is well acknowledged. Just moving on to slide 8 and the amount feature itself. Certainly heard some interest, particularly from users, on having an approach which distinguishes between claims that vary with economic resources and claims that are independent of economic resources. And the amount feature does that in a particular way. That said, overall, the amount feature, I think, is seen as a combination of clarifying what IAS 32 already requires in terms of obligations settled in own shares and derivatives involving own shares, a combination of that, but also an extension of the concept of liabilities by taking account of the amount of a claim on liquidation, which IAS 32 broadly excludes from the analysis. Quite a lot of pushback in terms of looking at what happens on liquidation and a view that this is inconsistent with the going concern presumption. In terms of its practical effects, I think the changing classification of cumulative preference shares is the sort of classroom example. But the instruments which is generating most comment, or category of instruments, are hybrid bonds, which are certainly quite commonplace in the European market. 2018 will amount to about 5% of the total market in new issuances of bonds, and about a 20 billion euro market in total. So it's not entirely clear whether the classification would change in its entirety for that whole category, but there is a concern. One comment made is that these proposals would destroy the whole hybrid bond market. Which might be a rather over-dramatized statement, but it's a comment that was made, and that's the instrument that's attracting most attention. These instruments, by the way, they have a stated coupon rate. They are that the coupon is ultimately discretionary under the terms of the contract. They're normally perpetual, but the issuer has various call options exercisable at certain dates. Some of them feature step-up clauses, so the ultimately discretionary coupon steps up. If it's not paid, that rolls up into the amount due on liquidation, which means it's classified as a liability under the amount feature. And there might be some other bells and whistles, if I can use that phrase, other complications, such as a dividend linking feature, which means that you have to pay the coupon if you pay an ordinary dividend, and vice versa. So I think there's some acknowledgements that to some stakeholders, these kind of look awfully like debt. Right. And would behave awfully like debt in a going concern scenario, but nonetheless some concern about the changing classification. Just one final point on the classification before I move on. We did in our draft comment letter suggest the IASB should consider more carefully the pros and cons of requiring all derivatives to be classified at fair value through profit or loss. Could be a simplification benefit. I have to say there does not seem to be much appetite so far for going down that route. So whether that survives in our final comment letter, we'll have to see after going through our normal process. But not seeing a groundswell of support right now for what would be quite a radical change. Just moving on to the presentation aspect, slide 9. And first of all, with the proposal to present income and expenses on certain liabilities within other comprehensive income and without recycling, where I think some of the literature talks about where the return is equity-like, but the actual scope proposal in the discussion paper is more tightly defined than that, I think. Certainly hearing some acknowledgement that recognising gains and losses in profit or loss for instruments that or liabilities that increase in proportion to the entity's value or share price, for some is counterintuitive, but counterintuitive is rather a subjective concept, and not everyone shares the view it's counterintuitive. I mean, those that do share that view have got questions around how to get the scope right, because, as I said, the discussion paper is quite specific in the proposed scope. This could, of course, be fine-tuned. But there are other instruments, such as profit participating bonds, that, at least based on our understanding, would not qualify for the OCI presentation. But the same phenomenon, that the amount of the liability goes up when the entity performs well, would occur with profit participating bonds, but those would not qualify for OCI. So mixed views overall, but I think if you pursue this route further, some more work and to get the scope, I won't say right, but to optimise the scope in some way. Moving on to slide 10 and the attribution proposals for subclasses of equity instruments. Preparers, perhaps unsurprisingly, we're hearing pushback that this is adding complexity. We've been trying to understand the views of users on the extent to which this information would actually be useful so that the potential benefits would be commensurate with the costs. Right now, I don't think we've heard a whole lot of support for attribution within equity. Certainly hearing strong acknowledgement, particularly from users, that they need more information about subclasses of equity and need to be able to distinguish between, for example, if hybrid bonds were to carry on being classified as equity, if they're going to behave in a debt-like fashion on a going concern basis, then users need to know that. But attribution right now isn't really resonating, and here's some observations that the different approaches put forward in the discussion paper to allocate comprehensive income to derivative type equity instruments yield very different answers. So what does that say about how to interpret the information provided? Moving on to slide 11 and disclosures. Overall here, the message is more positive, reflecting earlier comments I've made that users find it difficult to obtain all the information they need to make their analyses on liabilities with some equity-like features and equity with some liability-like features, if I can put it that way. today, so an improvement in the information set is called for. Inevitably, any discussion about disclosure gets associated with the ongoing Principles of Disclosure project, so how would this fit into that is a question that would, of course, need to be addressed. I think the challenges around providing sufficient information on terms and conditions to be useful, but without adding pages and pages and pages to the financial statements, have been widely discussed. One suggestion, actually an event only yesterday, was that the objective should be to give enough information in the financial statements to kind of flag that there's something about this instrument that should cause users, diligent users, to go and look for more information elsewhere, such as in a prospectus document, might be one way to think about it, but it wouldn't be feasible to provide all the information about terms and conditions at a granular level in a set of financial statements. And some comments around how you can actually make an order of priority on liquidation meaningful at a consolidated level, given that liquidation is fundamentally a company-by-company concept, not a consolidation concept. But that could be worked through, but a recognition that more is called for. Finally, under slide 12, just a few other bits and pieces, really. Our draft comment letter questioned whether it was appropriate to eliminate the foreign currency rights issue exception. We haven't actually heard much commentary either way about that. I guess these are not particularly widespread transactions, but they're important to those to whom they're important. I think hybrids I've mentioned already and written puts. The other comment I make about written puts over NCI, the discussion paper aims to clarify the accounting within equity, and for written puts with NCI, the debit would result in a derecognition of the NCI. Mm-hmm. But we're getting some questions about how that interacts with the present ownership guidance in IFRS 10. So I think that's a sort of a known unknown. Making it a known known would be welcome. So that's my efforts to summarise in about 15 minutes what we've heard in from several hundred different stakeholders.
Thanks for the summary, Andrew. It's very interesting. What I was going to do is just make a few observations on things we've been thinking about that I think would be helpful for us, if you could think about them when you're finalising your comment letter, which builds a little bit, I think, on some of the things that you were mentioning. One of the points that has been coming up a lot, and I've done quite a bit of outreach on this project, and it certainly comes up wherever I go, is a concern about how much cost and effort there might be for people to get to the same classification outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair point and something we need to be very conscious of. What I'm trying to encourage people to think about, and I know it's easy for me to say, is, you know, if in 10 years' time you had this model to apply, would we be in a better place? Because I think if we were to go ahead with what's in the DP, we need to think carefully about how we might make transition more manageable, and we can do that. So, for example, if we really thought generally classification wasn't going to be changed, would it be a situation where we might think about prospective application only or only targeting particular instruments for reassessment? So I think it would be great if people flagged that that's an important issue, but try not to sort of let it overshadow everything else. Something I've heard also loads about when I've been out talking to people, consistent with your feedback, is concerns about the amount feature. And what I'm particularly interested in the feedback we get, and it'd be great if you guys could think about it when you're writing to us on the amount feature, is what exactly it is that's troubling people. Because I think some people probably are focused mainly on a disagreement with whether it's correct to focus on what would happen in a bankruptcy-type situation for going concern accounting. So that's sort of one issue. But if we were to deal with that, do people agree with the general notion of the amount feature being relevant absent liquidation? So is it the amount idea that people disagree with or the liquidation concern? So unpicking those two things would be really helpful for us. And the other thing about the amount feature is it the articulation and the complexity of that, which I think is a fair consideration because it's not easy to draft that. So even if you agree with the idea, do we need to do a better job with the articulation? And one of the things that I think is useful for us to also get feedback on is if you don't agree with the idea of the amount feature, one of the benefits of the amount feature, if we could get it to work and if people did agree with it, would be one way of addressing the fixed for fixed words for derivatives. gives us a different articulation of the same idea. So if you don't like the amount feature, what would you be suggesting we do about 6 for 6 would be helpful for us to know. On the cumulative preference shares, that's probably the single most raised issue everywhere I've been, and certainly seems like you've got the same feedback. I think something we're going to try and work hard on from our side, and if you have the opportunity to do so between now and January, would be good as well, is what do investors think? Because I think a lot of the reaction we're getting is from preparers saying, well, I get equity classification today and I don't want to be moved to liability classification, and I can understand that. But when investors are looking at these instruments, given that loads of people have told us over the years they don't think it's necessarily very representationally faithful, that you end up with a liability, an equity classification for things which are priced as debt, marketed to debt investors, act a lot like debt. If we're not going to use the amount feature, you know, how do we reconcile that investor need? And is it, in fact, the investor view? That's something that I'm asking the staff to dig more into as we get further into the responses that we get. Do investors agree with us that we should be thinking about these types of instruments as debt, or is this something that we've just sort of come up with ourselves? And the last request I'll make before I shut up is on the ranking and liquidation. When we talk to investors, we get a lot of positive feedback on that from the meetings I've been in and from what I understand from the staff. And when we developed it, we thought we were building on something similar that exists in other jurisdictions, which we understand is useful for investors. And I understand that it can be difficult in a consolidated set of financial statements to think about ranking and liquidation because of things like minority interests. Mm-hmm. I understand that bit. But I think in terms of the idea that liquidation is obviously a separate legal entity concept, I think what we were thinking was, let's just assume everybody falls in a heap at once. Mm-hmm. What is the ranking then? And that was our logic. So if we take that mindset, I'd be interested to understand, is it still something that's difficult to do? Mm-hmm. And is it because of this idea of, you know, in a group structure, where do you rank is a bit of an odd concept because of separate legal entities? Or is it a clarification? And why is it more difficult here than what we had understood in other jurisdictions would also be useful for us?
Okay, you've got a good shopping list, Andrew.
Yeah.
Alexander?
The meaning of the word disruptive in slide 8 become more clear now after your presentation. And my question here is it an intended consequence, or is it an intended consequence of this standard? Because we have the same discussion in Brazil. Back in 2010, we have a company that issued this cumulative bond. There is a big discussion between auditors and, at the time, the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Securities and Exchange Commission saying, well, this is a liability because you cannot avoid payments in the future. And auditors saying, well, everybody in Europe use that and classifies that as equity. And my view is that this new version is pretty much solving this issue, classifying those instruments as a liability, not as equity. So at least the view that we had in the outreach in Brazil was that, well, this is not an intended consequence. It's an intended consequence. So most of those instruments will be classified as a liability. Mm. As a consequence of that, most banks are complaining and saying, well, you're going to kill the market because nobody's going to issue these instruments in the first place. You have to classify that as a liability. And people are saying, well, if you are issuing an instrument just because of the accounting classification, you should not be issuing this instrument in the first place. Mm-hmm. But this is not considered to be an intended consequence. And I don't know if it's unintended, it's intended. This standard is going to have an effect on the market. So it's actually going to affect the amount of private securities issuance in the market as a whole, because some companies say, if you have to classify that as a liability, I'll not issue this instrument. Period. So is that correct? Is an intended consequence? It's not an unintended consequence.
We're not surprised that that's the outcome. That's what you're asking.
And
our understanding, and it was partly in response to a number of comments that have been made in the past about how counterintuitive it seems that given the way that these types of instruments behave, that they get equity classification today. Now, and so that's why I said, and certainly some of the investors we've spoken to have told us that today, despite the fact it's equity classified, they treat it as debt when they do the analysis of entities.
100% correct. But our companies tell is that, well, I know that investors reclassify that as a debt, but I issue that expecting to classify as equity for covenant reasons, because it doesn't matter what the investors reclassify that, but for covenant violation reasons, so it's classified as equity is important.
Contractual
reasons, generally speaking, they expect that to be classified as equity. What I heard from people, if you classify that as a liability, you're not going to issue these instruments. It's which for me, I personally, if you're issuing an instrument just because of the accounting classification, which is an asymmetry with the market believes is a liability. But if you issue that and classify as an equity because you can avoid violation of covenants, I'm 100% with this standard. My point is that it is not an unintended consequence. It's a pretty much intended. You're gonna kill this market. This market of playing the rule, playing the accounting rule, is going to disappear. It's a huge market. Mm-hmm. So sure. Don't get surprised. But, it's billions of dollars just in Brazil. I don't know how the rest of the world.
Mary?
I was just going to draw on one or two outreach meetings that I did here that focused particularly on these instruments. And it was interesting. First of all, a lot was being made of the fact that the rating agencies had recently, at least one of the rating agencies recently had changed its evaluation of these instruments so that they gave them 50% equity credit independent of the accounting classification. So it's treated 50% as equity, 50% as liability, but under certain conditions. And the conditions were that because most of these apparently are callable by the entity after a period of time, and the practice is to call them, that the company had to have a plan in place to refinance them, so they were being treated as equity on the basis that they would get called but replaced with similar instruments. And the basic consensus of the meeting was these things are issued as debt, priced as debt, regarded by investors as debt, and often treated by tax authorities as debt, although it's an accounting bonus that they get equity treatment.
Yeah, it is. But let me get into this example that I gave you exactly this point. Even if the rating agents get 50-50, what happens is, imagine a company that's about to break a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And if you issue this instrument, it classifies that as an equity, the company doesn't break the covenant, despite the fact that nobody believes that's equity. But he avoids the covenant violation, which is pretty expensive to break a covenant.
It is, but
at the least.
But think also of what it's telling investors, users of financial statements.
But the banks that extend these credits and have these loan covenants with their
banks treat that as a liability. That's absolutely clear.
Okay.
It's written everywhere in the prospects.
So why would reclassification then?
No, I'm not against it. I'm just saying that it's not an unintended consequence.
Yeah.
People have to be aware of
understanding the dynamics.
Banks already see it as liability in their covenants. Then a change in accounting treatment would
be. No, but the covenant, covenants is a bigger issue, because covenants involve a lot of investors, the way they're written in the contract. Some of the covenants can even ask for.
They can just adjust the covenants.
Yeah, but this is, you can, but it's not the reality today. The reality today is book value effect. That is debt to equity, your covenant.
I don't understand, because you say banks see these things as liabilities.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
But
that,
then why do they not adjust their covenants?
Say that. Now, the covenants are not only written with banks. You have public issues of those debts. It's not only written with banks. It's a public issues. And most of the covenants today, that can be changed in the future, but today, most of the covenants, there is this clause of debt to equity, which is pure accounting debt to equity. I'm not saying that's right. My only point is this. Do not assume that this is an intended consequence. This is an intended consequence.
Yeah,
You're going to kill this market.
Okay. You, Chen?
Okay. First of all, I would like to share what the project team in China did during this period. From the perspective of China, we think this project is very important. So after the ISB published the DP, the project team in China, we translated the full text of the DP and seek the comments from the Chinese stakeholders. The comment period is from September to the end of November. Now we have got a lot of comments, and we are now doing the analysis. Basically, because there are a lot, at present, there are a lot of perpetual debt issued in the interbank market in China. It's more than 1 trillion, and a lot of companies, especially from the power or the real estate industry, they issued a large number of perpetual debt in Hong Kong or Singapore and somewhere else. So it's a very important topic for China. Secondly, I would like to share our preliminary observations based on the feedback we got. Generally, the stakeholders think that actually we have a similar feeling with what the IFRIC presented just now in the slides. They think the new approach in the DP is intended to be resulting mostly the same result. So in their opinion, in the stakeholders' opinion, that they hope the DP could solve, could address the issues, especially those controversial issues in practice, rather than retelling the framework of liability and equity. We also feel that it will take some time for the stakeholders to understand the new terminologies in the DP, and it's very difficult for them to apply in practice as well. Their major concerns include three aspects. One is how to account for the written puts on non-controlling interest. The second one is how to consider the relationship between contractual term and the law. The third concern is about they need more guidance on the indirect obligations and the impact of the economic compulsion on contractual terms. So that's three areas that they mostly concerned about. Excuse me. And more specific, to be more specific, that I just want to share some of the observations we also get from the feedbacks. Some are very similar to the feedback from the IFRIC. First one is about the amount feature. Basically, the auditors didn't agree with this change. They suggest the board reconsider the issue of cumulative preferred stock and perpetual bond, and reconsider whether the amount feature is needed, or maybe the amount feature needs to be improved. The second one is on the new terminology. Because the stakeholders in China, they feel it's difficult to understand correctly for the new terminology. For example, the available economic resources in paragraph 3.17 in the DP mentioned that the available economic resources are the total recognized and unrecognized assets of the entity that remain after deducting all other recognized and unrecognized claims against the entity. They are very confused. What is the unrecognized assets? The second example is how to make judgment on whether the amount of the contractual obligation of a financial instrument is independent of its available economic resources. They need more explanations and illustrative examples. And they think currently the examples or guidance in the DP is not sufficient. The third comment is on the presentation. We share the similar feelings with the IFRAG. The Chinese stakeholder generally believe the presentation and disclosure requirement in the DP are too complicated. And some of them think that it will result in undue costs. And the last comment is on the, it's also similar to the IFRAG, that IFRAG is concerned about the proposal to remove foreign currency rights issue exception. The Chinese stakeholders suggest to retain this exception. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Linda.
Thanks. So we're fairly far along now with regard to our outreach, including outreach we did when Tom and Kumar were kind enough to come to Canada. So we have a wide range of stakeholders who we've interacted with, including practitioners, preparers, users, regulators across Canada. We've also talked to our own IFRS discussion group, our own user advisory council, our own academic advisory council, CPA Canada's Mining Task Force, CPA Canada's Oil and Gas Task Force, CPA Canada's Investment Funds Advisory Group, the bankers, the insurers, and pension fund investors. So it's pretty balanced and pretty widespread. Big picture, three themes that I'd like to mention is that in some of the discussions, and you, Tom and Kumar, you may hear slightly different flavor in a couple of areas just because we've had some more discussions, but just to remind us all that we're still in a relatively low interest rate environment and benign credit cycle, and that anything we do here should contemplate and be tested by something that would happen as a result of coming out of that environment. So in other words, more complex and interesting instruments tend to proliferate when you come into higher interest rate or high, you know, credit crisis kind of mentalities. And so we're in particular looking at, you know, kind of the range of instruments we think should be stress tested by some of the provisions in the document. So we're just reminding ourselves of that. Had similar comments around the work effort. And we got a little bit of conflicting advice there. In terms of, we've had IFRS 15 mentioned to us with regard to having had to do a whole lot of work for relatively small change. IFRS 16 doing a whole lot of work in preparation for that. Obviously, there's going to be change by instruments going on the balance sheet, so we're going to see that change. But where is this one going to fall ultimately in terms of the work effort? And your comments are, I think, similar to comments I've made, Sue, where, well, perhaps we can manage this through transition. We should take that into consideration. But we do find in Canada that the whole notion around the cumulative preferreds, and that's where the change is likely going to really play a big part. And so we're mindful of that because there could be more change than what you might have otherwise thought with regard to the discussion paper. Don't disagree that perhaps it's warranted change, but we are hearing, obviously, also from the banks and the insurers, is this could impact their capital, so they need time to manage through that. And unfortunately, like it or not, some people articulate, you know, this notion of the practice in Canada, which I don't actually honestly personally agree with, but the regulator in Canada tends to equate the accounting conclusion with the capital treatment, so we have to have those discussions. And I'm not saying that that is the standard setter's problem, because I don't think you should write an accounting standard setter based on capital. I'm just saying that that's something that we're hearing about. and we're going to have to figure out.
And we're certainly talking to Basel about that.
Yeah. We have heard a little bit about the notion of, I just need to hit a, I don't want to repeat a lot of things, but just a couple other things I'll mention. The notion of the definition of the financial liability and in this document compared to the new conceptual framework and IFRS 2 share-based payments, and that's a, we've had that come up in numerous conversations, so we'll mention that. The amount feature, most of the same things you've been hearing and mentioned have been highlighted to us. Also, this notion of having to think about unrecognized assets, they wonder how, especially the preparers, wonder how far they're going to have to reach to do that. So they don't quite really understand the amount feature per se, and they're worried about the complexity of trying to figure that out. And the notion of playing up against a liquidation concept versus a going concern concept. So similar things that way. I'm going to go through that. So we're going to give you in our letter some things also about the puttable. We've got some comments on that. In particular, the way it plays out in our setting, there's an issue around the application of 16D. When you have a limited partner interacting with a general partner, it gets pushed out right away. It doesn't necessarily make sense to us that it would get pushed out of the puttable exception, so we'll come back to you on that with some specifics. And so we'll do that. The users, I agree also, a lot of the users like the notion of more disclosure around the equity. So they would like more disclosure around the terms and what ultimately could happen in the notion of the waterfall. But I think we're going to go back with the notion of the consolidated entity and try to simplify that a bit to see if we can get a more outreach on that, because I haven't specifically had questions, had conversations in that ilk, Sue. I think it is hard for them to understand that. Another big picture comment was the proposed use of OCI. And so the comment there was they're not quite sure that in this proposal you're going to in essence make what they perceive as more use of OCI without clarifying really what OCI is. Although when pushed, the users say, well, I don't really want it in P&L, so I guess OCI is better. Okay, and then it goes into that black hole of OCI. So we will probably let
that comes quite pretty close to the conceptual
that's
definition.
Kind of
of
so they
OCI.
Do understand the concept.
That's the definition of OCI.
I know. So that's a bit of a wrestling contest as well in terms of that. So my sense is that we are fairly close in most respects to what you're hearing from other jurisdictions. My one last comment would be a very logistical one. Your choice of a deadline of January the 7th is somewhat problematic when you're trying to get this through a board due process. So would encourage you when you do set a deadline not to make it quite so close to the holiday season, because we'll get it there, but it's not pretty, and I don't have a happy board right now. That's it.
Paul?
Thank you. I agree with many of the comments that have already been said. We're pretty close to finalising our letter. I'm afraid it's probably going to come across slightly more negative than is ideal. And I think probably two things that perhaps influence that. The first one being that I think if we were to start again, we'd be pushing quite hard that there was more of a fundamental review of the principles rather than trying to focus in on some specific areas. So I think that affects the overall tone of our response. I think there are some things we fundamentally agree with. So we think there is it is appropriate for a binary distinction between liabilities and something else. We wouldn't necessarily sit on equity. We might use shareholder funds, but that's perhaps something dating back a long time ago in UK GAAP. We also agree that no binary distinction can be adequate, and therefore there needs to be a lot of disclosure that goes with it, particularly around the equity instruments, which has been described. We actually do agree with the fact that both timing and an amount are important, but we do have some difficulty with some of the complexity and practicalities within that. And I think in particular I welcome the point that Sue made around taking away the issue around insolvency liquidation. I think that would be a helpful advance. But I think also there needs to be greater consistency in how those terms are used, both within the discussion paper, but also with the conceptual framework. And I think that's a point that Linda has already made. There's clearly, we're getting quite a bit of feedback around the cost and practicalities for companies. And again, maybe to some degree in the UK, these instruments are not the instruments which have complexity attached to them, which we're trying to tackle through the discussion paper, are not as widespread as in many other jurisdictions in consolidated accounts which are prepared under IFRS. They typically arise much more in private equity-backed businesses or within subsidiaries as part of reorganisations. And there, as you know, in the UK, you don't have to follow IFRS. So I think some of the challenges are more for UK GAAP than it is for IFRS. But as I say, we will get our letter into you in good time, and we'll try and put some suggestions of how one might tackle some of the things that we see as challenges.
Thank you. Alberto.
Well, the OIC is supportive of this project and also agree on the main principle on which the project is based. But we think that more guidance should be needed for compound instrument, and especially for the written put option on non-controlling interest, including our favorite topic, a recognition of separate financial statement. We also believe that in your journey to provide an exposure draft and then a standard, you should do a good effect analysis, because we have a feeling, not sure, but we have a feeling that there might be unintended consequences because of this new concept. We also would suggest the ISB to consider recycling for the fair value changes of equity-linked financial instrument.
Yeah, we'll just have that.
And we also suggest to clarify some terms, specifically what is meant by liquidation, because liquidation is a legal meaning in most countries, and so might be interpreted with the eyes of, you know, the corporate law, rather than with an accounting vision in mind. So if you are able to say, by liquidation in this context, we mean blah, 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 it would be very helpful and would bring consistency around the application. And on the attribution, we would suggest to work on IS 33 about requiring disclosure on liquidation, on dilution, rather than the attribution on the face of the financial statement. And final point, we strongly support retaining the putable exception.
Yukio.
Thanks. Firstly, I'd like to introduce the views we had from our constituent. Users were generally positive about the project, in particular the proposed improvement in the disclosure requirement. Users were particularly supportive of presenting the priority of claims on liquidation and presenting the potential dilution of ordinary shares. Users thought that the ISB should proceed with improving disclosures. Even if the ISD cannot improve the distinction between ability and equity. Preparers from financial institutions, except for some cooperative organizations, are not so interested in the project because they focused on the Basel requirements, which define the capital separately from accounting requirements. Financial institutions focused on the implications of proposals from the holder's point of view, and that is the implications on the measurement of investment. Preparers in other industries generally were not interested either because their capital structure was relatively simple. These preparers were concerned with specific proposals such as the extended use of OCI to some financial liabilities and the attribution of the total comprehensive income to each equity instrument. In particular, how line items would be presented within equity. Academics were concerned that the implications of proposed classification principles on the definitions of the elements in the conceptual framework were not necessarily clear in the discussion paper. Academics stated that it was conceptually necessary to distinguish liabilities from equity to determine income and expense. And if the ISD were to fundamentally rethink the distinction between liability and equity, they thought that basic ownership approach mentioned in the discussion paper may be an approach worth consideration, although they acknowledged that equity may be too restrictive. Secondly, I'd like to summarize the tentative views of the ASBJ. We acknowledge that the attempt to provide the rationale for the classification of liability and equity may be helpful to improve how the classification principles are applied. However, given that there would be a limited change in the classification outcome from that under IS 32, and the issues identified may not necessarily be resolved by clarifying the rationale, we think that the cost of developing a revised standard may outweigh the benefit. We observe that improvement under this approach would be limited to specific area, such as the clarification of the fixed for fixed condition and the problem arising from economic comparison. In addition, the discussion paper proposed to retain the exception for portable instrument in IAS 32, which would also be an exception to the proposed principles. This may imply that the proposed principles are insufficient to describe the classification outcomes. We observe that aside from the measurement issues arising from IFRS 9, issues arise from IS 32, not because they are based on unclear rationale of the principles, but from the unclear unit of account to which such principles are applied. We think that the discussion paper addressed an issue related to NCI put. From this perspective. And accordingly, we think that it would be more effective and more efficient for the ISB to consider the unit of account. On the other hand, if the ISB were to comprehensively review the requirement under IS 32, we think that the ISB should fundamentally reconsider the principle in order to achieve consistent and fundamental classification. We have been exploring possible alternatives, And we think that the basic ownership approach could be one candidate because of its simplicity and because users prefer that approach. At the same time, we acknowledge the challenges of this approach. Considering the history of the discussion of this approach, we think that we need to make some modification if we are to explore this approach further. Finally, as Linda mentioned, if you know the ISB permits the extension of the due date of the comment letter, it's very useful for us. Thank you very much.
Chris?
Thanks, Hans. So from an AOSSG perspective, quite a lot of comments that Andrew made from an EFRAG perspective resonated quite well. So I'll just pick up on a couple of key things. The foreign currency rights issue is actually very, very big for Asia. Mm-hmm. So there is some real concern about that, and that's largely because countries in the region generally have to go to other markets to actually raise the capital. So whilst there's an understanding that foreign currency rights are actually very similar in substance to the foreign currency convertible bonds, nobody really understands your rationale for why you chose to put everything into the liability bucket rather than the equity bucket. Because if we think about the portables exemption in the DP, you basically said, we've retained this exemption because we don't think these proposals address the underlying issues that caused the first exception. Everyone's saying we think the same approach applies equally to foreign currency rights. You haven't made the argument why you've taken away the exception for the rights, because you equally had a choice to move the bonds into equity, but you chose to go the other way. So I think there's that concern. And that comes out a little bit because, again, people are very concerned about the amount feature and don't necessarily understand and think it's a very complex approach. And then there's also a number of countries, at least four in the region, that are very concerned that you haven't done the conceptual piece, which, again, is picking up some of the themes. And the concern is if you did that conceptual piece, you might not end up with the same answer that you've actually got. And so there's concern that you're going to make people change and then they might change again. So the suggestion is that you do need to think about that broader concept and make sure that those things are aligning. So you asked the question about the amount feature and what the concerns were. Certainly some of the countries in the region are concerned about the liquidation piece and feel that that's not been clearly explained as to why that's there. So we understand you were trying to pick up fix for fix, but again, if you go back to the conceptual piece, it's, well, how does this actually fit, and then why is this new approach there? And there's also some concern about the fact that in terms of the independent criteria, people just don't understand those concepts. And the fact that you've actually had to go through and identify what the different features are as to what's actually independent versus dependent is actually perhaps indicative that there's not a principle there and that that's also just creating some more rules. And so, you know, is this really actually going to take us forward? So we did ask the question. So this was actually discussed at a number of AOSSG working group meetings, but also was discussed at the broader AOSSG annual meeting. And it's sort of evenly split between those who responded as to whether or not you should continue with the project. So it was 50-50. So some members did think, yes, you should continue with the project, and others thought, no, the costs are really outweighing the benefit. In terms of those who are saying don't go ahead, it was a bit evenly split between those that said go back and do the conceptual piece and then those that were saying a little bit like, as Japan was suggesting, you can actually deal with some of this through the disclosure piece and then have a think about the longer term issue. So I think really the messaging is this is, no one's really terribly enthusiastic about the proposals, but do acknowledge that there's some issues with 32 and that those are actually going to get worse as we go forward.
Sue?
Just on the amount feature and the fixed for fixed. One thing that I'm trying to think how best to articulate this. So when we started doing this project, I was probably one of the ones who thought that 32 worked reasonably well. I'm probably already on public record saying that, so that's probably okay. I'm not selling any secrets. But the thing that has struck me actually when I've been doing the outreach is that the diversity of application and the analysis that's being undertaken under 32 today is not what I had thought when I started the looking at this project. And so I think that one of the things that would be, I think, for example, it will be, for me, very difficult for us not to do something on fixed for fixed, given what I've learned during the outreach. So I already knew that nobody applied the words fix for fix because it just doesn't work, to be blunt, because of share splits and all of that sort of stuff. When I was in banking, people didn't apply fix for fix, but they did things like allowed for, I don't know, adjustments in number of shares on convertible bonds for dividend payments, because there's a link, in theory at least, between share price and dividend payments. So, you know, people have, I think, generally got comfortable. But since then, because we've got a situation where nobody's actually applying the words in the standard, more and more and more and more things have started to be accommodated. And so I think that it will be difficult for us to do nothing in this space would be my takeaway. Maybe we don't need to do or shouldn't do something as comprehensive as what's in the discussion paper, but I think it will be really important for us to get some ideas on what we do around this amount feature, because I think we do need to come up with some form of clarification, whether that's a tweak to 32, interpretation, guidance, or whatever form. I think we can be open, but I think we really need to work out how best to deal with some of that stuff.
Kumar?
Just to come up on that, and something that also the comment came from Unusan. I've done, as you know, quite a bit of outreach as well, and one of the things, let me echo this, and it's not just fixed for fixed that we heard this, but after a point it was also acknowledged for certain things like mandatorily convertible notes and other things. What we had assumed to be the classification in particular parts is not exactly what is being done. So one of the things that I would like to also emphasize, which Sue has put in, is that we do need to give, and that's why we tried to come up with some of the principles behind that, so that, like Sue mentioned, that if it is linked to dilution, maybe it's something that is within the ambit of fix for fix. Obviously, fully understand articulation of these things we need to work on and things. So what I would also very much request, that also, Unusan, you mentioned the unit of account, and maybe it's linked to that. I don't understand that fully. But we do need to come and think about what exactly is happening with fixed or fixed, because this is an outreach feedback that has come to us and from quite a few jurisdictions, and bringing together quite a bit of preparers, structurers, and other people and on the table. So that would be useful, Chris. It means how do I bring in consistency of the application? Because that was certainly one of the objectives with which we started and why we started coming up with the concepts or the principles behind the fixed for fixed.
Cedric?
Thank you, Hans. Well, a lot of things have been already said, so I will just put some additional comments. In France, we support the project and think that it deserves standard setting. We have commented a couple of times on the difficulties, the conceptual and practical difficulties in applying IS 32 because of the lack of guidance, which leads to difficulties at IFRIC level, and the inconsistencies between, or some inconsistencies that may raise between different paragraphs applying IS 32, which leads to structuring opportunities. We particularly appreciate the emphasis which is put on disclosure improvements, except for the attribution.
That's a big problem.
but we think in that area it may be we could provide maybe some additional information on specific provision in certain compound instruments if there are really key for determining whether the classification. Sure. And not only from a technical point of view, but also providing sometimes the expression of the management intent, which may be also relevant in that classification or in that assessment, finally. With regard to the topic of indirect obligation and the question of substance, I think there is I wouldn't say a consensus because we are not so far, but people understand that economic compulsion may not be the solution, but there is still an issue regarding the substance and how we define it, and we encourage drilling further down in that analysis, because it's a key one. Another point which is also very important in France is the debate on the classification regarding the putable instruments, because our understanding is that because they are an exception to a principle, they have not the same status than the principle itself, with in the symmetry from the issuer to the holder, and the effect on IFRS 9. And we think it's important to clarify what is supposed to be the definition of equity, what is the status of an exception in that regard from a conceptual point of view, and if we think such an asymmetry is conceptually sound or not, which also relates to the definition or the substance also of OCI and the effect on P&L. Final remark on written put option on NCI, we also encourage maybe to take into consideration IFRS 10 and an impact directly in equity that was also suggested in the past. So it's clear that it is an extension because it goes beyond IS 32 only, but maybe in that case it could make sense and help provide some solution. Thank you.
Mary?
First thing I wanted to do is call out Yukio as my hero in terms of feedback that he was given, because I thought, Yukio, it was very helpful the way you were able to segregate the feedback by type of stakeholder. And I encourage all of you as you're finalizing your letter to think not only about the big chunks of the discussion paper, you know, the issues about classification, issues about presentation, issues about disclosure, kind of by topic, but also to think about the feedback you've had and if it's consistent across all stakeholder types, or if it's inconsistent between stakeholder types. And you know, Yukio, for example, even when you were talking about financial institutions providing feedback, your insight that they were commenting more as holders of these instruments rather than issuers of these instruments is very helpful for understanding the context of comments. So would ask everybody to think about trying to do that to the maximum extent possible. And then I did just really want to emphasize the point that I think others have touched on to differing degrees. In some ways, the discussion paper is a package of not quite standalone topics, the classification guidance, the presentation issues, the disclosure proposals, particularly around equity classified instruments, and thinking about each of those maybe if you're thinking of some kind of summary overview of your response, thinking about commenting on each of those aspects separately, I think it will help us understand the feedback. Then the last thing I'll do, which might get me black marks from many around the table, both inside my organization and outside, is Sue was careful and Kumar was diplomatic when talking about classification, and I think I will just be blunt, which is, you know, I came into this project and have for many years kind of dismissing the basic ownership approach as a basis for classification because it is so crude and so simplistic, and I think fails to capture a lot of the nuances of the instruments that we see out there. But when I think about what Sue was saying about what we are finding out about practice in terms of applying IS 32 and either how much people struggle in terms of sincere, you know, differences in readings, or how much people exploit or take aggressive readings, combined with the, you know, concerns about the complexity, the possibility of revisiting, it does make me say, if we think we have to fix, and I think we do, if we have to address classification, and people think that the amount feature, which to me is an underlying concept for fixed in particular, if that is not workable, I think there is really a point at which we have to step back and say, can we have something that is trying to reflect all these nuances, or do we have to have a very straightforward classification approach and then place more emphasis on disclosure and other information in terms of solving these classification things? Or is that, you know, because it does come across as a very expensive piece of machinery with very high maintenance costs on an ongoing basis. So, I think that's beyond the scope of what we were talking about in the discussion paper. But as I think about the feedback we're hearing on the classification leg, and I do start anticipating, you know, next discussions, what do we do? I just, Yukio, I was happy to hear you raising that as, you know, one of the things that at least some of your constituents, and, you know, you're saying a preliminary view of the AFBJ for your response was considering, because I think, you know,
Mary, I don't understand very well what you're trying to say.
Okay. All of the classification, you know, we're hearing a lot of resistance on the classification leg. It needs to be more nuanced. It needs to consider this. Is it management intent? Is it, you know, economic incentives? This doesn't work. It has to be tuned. Is it just so hard to do something that we have to take a very blunt instrument and say, it's only the most basic instrument that gets equity classification? All of these other things that today, if they have this and if they have that, but they don't have this, get equity classification. But then what if I tweak this or rebalance that? Maybe just say it's too complicated to try and make differences for all those nuances and say, if it's not common equity, it's not equity. Mm-mm. It's liability. Mm.
Okay.
That is, you know, that is the basic ownership approach. And I'm not trying to spark it, but I think if you are looking at comment letters, you know, developing, finalizing your comment letters and looking at your feedback, and all of it is the litany about why this needs further work, why this needs more nuance, why this needs more guidance, why this needs more examples, I think you have to ask the question of, can this really be done in a way that we aren't doing standard setting on classification every other year?
I think if we have started with this approach, they would all be clamoring for the discussion solution. Won he?
Thank you, Hans. Korea is doing our own outreach activities, so I just share how we are doing this, and I will share also our overall feedback so far. I talked with our CASPIS Financial Instrument Expert Committee, and I also brought this agenda to the CASPIS Advisory Committee. And we are still in the process of collecting written comments from the general public. So the overall feedback I've received so far is, I would say, it is mixed. So generally, majority of preparers said that it is quite difficult to understand the new concepts in the DP. So their initial response or reaction is that it will be quite a burden for them to introduce to apply the new standards or the new principle in the near future. So I think that they've just come to terms with IS-32, although it is difficult standards, through the years of implementation of IS-32, and they think that if there were another big change, and then they think that it will be quite a burdensome for them. And it is even so because they had to deal with major changes arising from the new major standards like IFRS 9, 15, and 16. But there were some auditors who supported this principle, especially from the auditors who are very familiar with IS 32. They think that the amount feature and timing feature is clearer than the fixed principles. Mm-hmm. And particularly, they said that it is more intuitive to classify as liability the claim that has a fixed amount feature, regardless of timing features. Regarding the classification principles, some raised concerns about the new concepts. So, as many people said in this discussion, the new concepts like available economic resources and independence concept is not so clear compared to fixed concepts. And some didn't support the proposal as to the accounting of redemption obligation arrangement. They think that it would be confusing if protocol shares are derecognized at the time of insurance. And I also heard many concerns about the classification of cumulative preference shares. And regulators expressed a view that whatever new approach is adopted, people will come up with a new structured product to classify the product as equity. So, yeah, he's not so as enthusiastic about any approach. And regarding the presentation principle, some stakeholders think that criteria for OCI presentation is arbitrary and complex. But I also heard that some auditors said that it wouldn't be so complex to apply that criteria because normally there are not many different types of partially independent derivatives. The FX variable are the most common independent variable in that particular independent derivatives. So it is not so difficult to apply it. And also the criteria the ISB proposed is also consistent with the IFRS 9 criteria. So it's not so difficult one. And regarding the attribution of total comprehensive income to equity instruments, many stakeholders said that the cost of preparation would exceed the benefit of providing that information. And regarding disclosure principles, I heard some concerns about the disclosure of priority on liquidations. They said that it would be difficult to identify or verify the priority because this requires a legal verification. And also the benefit wouldn't be significant for the entities who don't have any going concern issues. And lastly, I just want to mention our two typical local issues. One is about a hybrid instrument that is very prevalent in Korea. And this hybrid instrument is classified as equity because it has some features that requires allows entity to defer the payment until the liquidation. So it is currently classified as equity. Mm-hmm. And under this ISB new approach, it would be classified as a liability or as compound instrument of both liability and equity. So some people say that this change would reflect the economic substance more faithfully, but some showed concerns about the impact on the entities which have already issued the instruments. And the last one, the instrument of bond with warrant, with which has the refixing clauses. So that bond with warrant has some anti-dilution provisions. And it means that it has some, it includes the features that the entity delivers a variable number of shares when the share price goes down, but it doesn't adjust the number of shares when the share price goes up. So many companies complain about incurring huge losses when share price increases. They say that it is very counterintuitive. And this ISCS approach, under the ISCS new approach, this instrument would still be classified as a liability. So they are, they just want to reconsider or to examine this product more carefully so that this instrument could be classified as equity or any other way. Anyway, we are going to deliberate this issue at the CASBIS December meeting, and we will deliver our comments by the deadline. Thank you.
Tak.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I ask a question to Chris to comment? I really appreciate your comment. However, one thing I just want to clarify is you said that we should go back to the conceptual basis. And can I ask what do you mean by that? I mean, what we are trying to do is to provide somehow a better underlying principle. And we could say it's a concept or a principle because we think it is necessary to provide something underlying things. And what we come up with is amount features. Of course, amount feature may have lots of shortcomings. However, what we are trying to do is to try to discuss the conceptual basis. So therefore, I just want to know, how could we meet your request? We should go back to conceptual basis.
So for those in the region who are raising the issue about conceptual basis, it's go back to the new conceptual framework. So if you think about the timing feature, that's absolutely tick consistent with where the definition of a liability is. The concern we have is that the amount feature actually doesn't necessarily tie in with the new conceptual framework. Mm. So the preference is, and so we understand that the conceptual framework was finalised on the basis that this project was going on, but we would have thought the starting point would be start with your new revised conceptual framework and then say, okay, if we did this, this is where we would land, but and we don't think that's the right answer for these reasons, so this is why we've got to where we've got to. Mm. And there's a whole lot of things that I think you actually need to think about. So, you know, fix for fix came about because it was an exception in terms of if you normally give over shares, we would normally say that's not actually costing the entity anything. So is it actually a liability? So fix for fix sort of came in and said, well, we think we need to make changes to that for these reasons. And the amount feature is sort of staying with that principle, but we haven't really teased out why we think that's the best answer. So what we're saying is, you know, you've got these new concepts, you need to actually start using them. And so if you've just, and as I said, the concern is you're going to make these changes and come up with a mount feature, and then you're potentially going to come along later at a point and look at it and go, okay, well, maybe we should go back and think about it again. And so I understand, again, this is an Australian perspective, not necessarily an AOSSG perspective, but if you think about in your DP, one of the things you talked about was there are ways of resolving this issue if you started to split things into their components and you actually said, okay, we've got a whole lot of hybrid instruments, even the foreign currency rights issue. What's the bit that's causing the problem? The bit that's causing the problem is the FX piece. Well, can you actually pull out the FX piece and actually deal with that?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a whole lot, and we talk about cost and complexity in the DP, which I think is important. But are those things going to change as we go forward? Because, you know, if investors are already doing some of that and splitting some of those things out, then are we really just trying to work out when's the right scenarios that you should be splitting out components and then when's the thing that the cost and complexity is actually too much? So I think there's a whole lot of conceptual things that you could be thinking about, but we've sort of landed without thinking that through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you very much for your comment. Yeah, I appreciate your comment, and I agree with you. But the current due process paper is just a discussion paper. We are not really proposing to change the each accounting transaction itself. Of course, it includes suggestions as a consequence of changing the our concept. So maybe I do understand there are some odd outcomes and which may change the practice, but rather than stick to the each outcome, we would like to discuss the concept a little further. That's why I was interested in your comment. Thanks.
So I think everyone's thinks that that's the right answer. A conceptual basis is better than a rule, but I think you've got to be careful to make sure that you get the right conceptual basis mm-hmm. and you don't end up with just more rules.
Okay. Sue?
So I guess so when we finished the conceptual framework, we sort of knew that we had done an incomplete job in terms of drawing the line between what was debt and what was equity, and I actually dissented on the ED on the conceptual framework because I would have preferred we did it all in one go, but I didn't win. But I think our plan was that we would take the feedback on this discussion paper and part of the decision we would make if we were to go forward with what the proposals are in the document would be that not only would we be thinking about a project to look at amending / replacing or whatever IAS 32, we'd also then be intending to circle back and think about, okay, so how now could we better articulate in the conceptual framework how we think about debt versus equity? So maybe we are thinking that we would use the feedback from this to do what you're proposing. I guess maybe what you're questioning, if I understand correctly, is whether there's enough in the discussion paper to have the thorough discussion about that to do that circling back. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Russ.
Thank you. I've been silent because we did not ask U.S. stakeholders about your discussion
document. That's very disappointing, Russ. Yeah.
That's because we currently have a project on our agenda focusing on how to improve this area in U.S. GAAP. And while we use different words, we have similar, to some degree, similar philosophy. A freestanding warrant is classified in the U.S. based on whether it is indexed to and settled in equity. And there have been a number of interpretations to help stakeholders understand what indexation means and what settlement means. Clearly, something that is purely fixed for fixed would meet that. But as Sue talked about, throughout the U.S., there's been a lot of questions and a lot of questions on questions as about whether or not something meets indexation or is fixed. And so I can tell you with very certainty all the questions you'll have to answer, because I think there may be 40-some examples in an EITF issue 07-1. And what we have found in our research is, first of all, with respect to hybrid instruments, U.S. GAAP has 5 different models. The combination of all of these different models and examples leads to the highest number of restatements on an annual basis in this area, and it is disproportionately worse for small public companies and private companies.
That's a very important
point. And that is because it is too difficult for the average accountant to understand. There are very highly technical experts in each national office that can get this right, and I think almost all of the contracts have to go through that at the large accounting firms. What we have found so far in our research is, with respect to hybrid instruments, is investors do not want them bifurcated. We've interviewed over 30 investors. We found 2 that ones that bifurcated. One, however, sits on my board. And that's because they don't want an instrument that cannot be separated, accounted for as if it was separated. That is very difficult for the accountants on my board to process and understand. We understand that there is a lower interest rate embedded in these, and we think it ought to be bifurcated and shown that way, but that is clearly not what investors want. What investors want is more disclosures about the terms and more disclosures about where these instruments fall within the waterfall. We recently held a private workshop on accounting for the freestanding instruments to see if there is a way in which we could put various thresholds and, in essence, say, don't account for, don't consider remote features. And my understanding, while I did not attend that, my understanding was there was some people thought it was a great idea. and others thought that it would be very difficult, and all we'd be doing is changing the analysis from what indexation means or what fixed means to whether something was or wasn't remote. Most people that believe that were in the approach that Mary Tokar talked about, which was the basic ownership approach. And in essence, what ultimately we, and I think you'll all have to decide, is how to transfer the complexity. Today, the complexity is in determining where to classify the instrument. One way to solve that is the basic ownership approach. It's pretty easy to know what you're supposed to do, but now you're going to have to fair value everything versus changing the complexity from the classification to maybe some complexity around remote. And that's kind of where we're working on. I'd be happy to ask the team to share any information they have. We're hopeful to start bringing the board decisions in the first quarter of next year.
Paul?
Thank you. I was just going to pick up something I think I heard Sue say a few moments ago, which was you use the discussion paper and any amendment that come as a result of that to IAS 32 to then backfill into the conceptual framework.
To think about whether we should.
Yes. Seems to me the wrong way round, in that...
That was the decision the board made.
Yeah. In that you'd have thought you'd, but yeah. You have the framework, you have the conceptual framework, and then you fill it in with the detail with particular standards.
But we knew at the time we finalised it that we were incomplete in terms of determining how to distinguish between debt and equity, and we decided it was more important to get that done and to focus on debt equity as a subsequent, potential subsequent step. It's not saying it's an automatic thing, but to think about whether that means that we've now got additional concepts that we can or should be doing to hum a few more bars in the conceptual framework. Not an automatic process, but something we've flagged we will think about.
With these difficult issues, it's sometimes better to reverse engineer the conceptual framework.
Those are your words.
Do you have any comments on that?
or at least make it an iterative.
Just going to put a new letter. You should reverse engineer the conceptual framework. Process with the word.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you, Michelle.
Okay. Well, probably a good time to stop these discussions.
Yes, I think we should kick off for that one.
Okay. Shall we have lunch? Till 1 o'clock?
Yeah.
Or
no, we can't go for lunch till one, but we may just have to wait for lunch to be served. But if we break for one, then I'll bring the sessions forward this afternoon by half an hour.
Yeah. Lunch is